This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 280. Today we speak about Jonathan Edwards' views about Adam before the fall. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 280. My name is Camden Busey. I am the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. I'm delighted to be with you today. We have a wonderful panel of guys and a great topic. Let me introduce them to you today. We have first Jeff Waddington, who is stated supply at Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. He is also the communications director for the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. Welcome back, Jeff. It's great to have you.
Oh, it's great to be here.
We've got some great news about Jeff we'll mention in just a minute, but before we get to that, we do want to introduce David Filson, who is teaching pastor at Christ Presbyterian Church, PCA, in Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome back, David. It's great to speak with you again.
Thanks. Good to be with y'all.
Yeah, well, we're excited to have the group together. This is an East of Eden post-trade. They swapped out Nick and brought in the scab, which is myself today. So I don't know a whole lot about Edwards, but I'm going to try to work my way through it, because today we're going to be speaking about Jonathan Edwards' anthropology, specifically looking at the prelapsarian state, how man was created, and how that could have afforded and eventually led to the fall of man. So we'll get into all of that. But first, we need to mention and announce, if people don't know already, that Jeff Waddington has successfully defended his dissertation for the PhD at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. It's been a long time coming, Jeff. We're so happy for you that you're able to get by.
Thank you. Yes, I'm all for to the grace of God and the kindness of the field committee.
Yeah, well, not only getting by, but excelling and doing well. And we're really happy for you. We posted it on the Facebook page. I don't know if you saw that, because I wasn't able to tag your name, but a lot of people sending in their congratulations, and also on Twitter. So a lot of people are happy for you, and we're so excited. We're going to have Dr. Waddington.
Yes. And now we just need to get you guys through.
Next time I'm up, Jeff, like I said, we'll go back to that wood-fired pizza place and celebrate.
Well, that was great. Yeah, what was the name of that place?
Oh, my goodness. It was next to that Toys R Us up there.
Yeah, right by the Cahoba. Is it Cahoba?
Wood-fired pizza.
It was between Cadoba and Toys R Us. So all the necessities of life, Mexican food, pizza, and Toys R Us.
Indeed. Well, that's sounds like there'll be a lot on your plate when you visit one another. Today we do have a lot on our plate, talking about Edwards.
No pun intended, right?
Oh, yeah. You like my segue? Yeah, pretty good.
Whoa.
But it's no good when you call attention to it, David, you see?
So sorry.
That's all right. But I do need to mention, in all seriousness, that Christ the Center is listener supported. We do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners and viewers to help us to continue to produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. We're so excited to be able to do what we do, but we need your help, especially in this time of transition. I'm in full-time pastoral ministry. Got a lot going on. We're hopefully going to be getting some help with editing and those sorts of things. So we're trying to put some processes and things in place to help us be sustainable, as well as to grow into the future. We need your help, so visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support today. We want to thank everybody so much for their support of everything we do here at Reformed Forum and this particular program, Christ the Center. Well, Jeff and David, both Jonathan Edwards fanatics in a good sense, I suppose, and we're taking the time out of East of Eden to talk about Edwards on Christ the Center. If you listeners do not know, we have an entire program devoted to the biblical and systematic theology of Jonathan Edwards called East of Eden. You can find that on the website at reformedforum.org, and you can subscribe to that specific feed if you would like to get that individually, if you don't already subscribe to everything that Reform Forum does. So just as a reminder, if you do subscribe to the podcast, there are a whole host of different feeds you can subscribe to: the general one, or individual programs to kind of mix and match your own playlist. East of Eden is one of those. Now, Jeff, could you explain a bit about your dissertation? I know we've talked about that in the past, but could you provide a refresher and an introduction to those who haven't heard? What was your topic and what, in general strokes, were you addressing in this great work?
Sure. The title of the dissertation was The Unified Operations of the Human Soul, Jonathan Edwards' Theological Anthropology and Apologetic. So I was trying to tie together what I could ascertain of Edwards' view of man and his apologetic practice, under the assumption or the guiding rule that how we understand man affects how we would defend the gospel. And there were five chapters, 347 pages or thereabouts altogether.
Oh man.
With the signature page and the introductions and all of that and the bibliography and so forth. I think it's 304 pages altogether of text.
Okay.
Now remember, that's double spaced, single sided.
Oh yeah.
The first chapter was stating the thesis or asking the question, was Jonathan Edwards a classical apologist? And my sparring partner is the late Dr. John Gerstner, for whom I have much affection and
not
respect
religious
for.
Affections.
Not that kind of. I only have religious affections for God. Moving on.
See what you get when you get me in instead of Nick Batzik. Right. That's my lame attempt at Edwards humor. So anyway,
hey, it works. So first chapter, I asked a question, and basically my argument is Edwards is a reformed apologist who is eclectic in his approach, and so is not quite the neat and clean classical apologist. But on the other hand, he's also not a Vantillian born out of time.
Sure.
So it's as my advisor asked during my oral defense, was this an anachronistic project or a project of anachronism? And I had to grant the point. And what he meant by that was Edwards predates what I would call apologetic self-consciousness. Mm-hmm. In other words, he did not write a book on apologetics, and he didn't say, I'm a practitioner of the classical method. He just did it. But anyway, so there's the first chapter with an introduction where I lay out the lay of the land of Edwards scholarship from the time of Perry Miller at the end of World War II up until the time I wrote the chapter. And you notice how I phrased that. Mm-hmm. Because I could have finished the chapter this morning and there'd be 500 new pieces on Edwards this evening. Edwards is only second to Abraham Lincoln, I think, in terms of the American who's had the most written about him.
Wow.
Yeah, I think Lincoln is first, and Edwards is number two. Mm. Okay, so then in that first chapter, I have a broad stroke history of Edwards scholarship. Then I look at four dissertations on Edwards' anthropology, and then I look at five or six scholars who've dealt with Edwards as an apologist, including Dr. Gerstner. Then I enter into the second chapter, which is what we're going to talk about in this episode, is dealing with Adam as created in the image of God. Third chapter deals with man's knowledge of God, both natural and special, based on natural and special revelation. Then there's a chapter on the relationship of the intellect to the will, which is really the heart of the dissertation. And then finally, the fifth chapter takes all of what we've learned from the first four chapters and looks at five instances of Edwards apologetic, mm-hmm. drawn from Of Being, the Romans 1:20 sermon, which has not, as far as I know, been published in print. It is available on the Jonathan Edwards Center website. The Freedom of the Will. Then his right. I just went blank. Well, the last one is the entry from the Notebook on Scripture, entry 416, on defending the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch. So I apologize for forgetting the fourth one in there. But anyways, that's the sweep of the dissertation. Again, I come to the conclusion that Edwards does follow some of the classical method on occasion, but quoting from Ava Chamberlain, one of the editors of the Yale edition of the works of Edwards, when Edwards made an argument, he presupposed the God that he was arguing for, and he presupposed the truth of the doctrine that he was supporting, which doesn't mean he was a presuppositionalist in our sense, but it does add complexity to the picture. Now, during my oral defense, questions, very good questions, by the way, were raised by the various faculty members, especially around the issue of how Adam created righteous could have had in the first place a sinful inclination. And that was, I'm not sure that I'm completely happy with how I answered that in the exam, but, I think that, as I told the professors, I think that reflects the fact that I am not God, among other things.
Indeed.
If you look at the history of theologians who've wrestled with this issue, and we'll get back to the details, but no, I don't think anyone has yet come up with, you know, a good explanation. And Gerstner himself said maybe we just have to leave it alone as something that the scriptures don't give us a definitive answer on. Now, David, you are an expert on Edwards. How would you describe Edwards' treatment of this question? How did Adam, who was created righteous, have a sinful inclination?
Well, first of all, I think calling me an expert on Edwards might be a stretch there, but it seems to me at the end of the day that it has to do with the nature of the creaturely, and it's not so much an issue of ability as it is inclination. And, you know, was there necessary grace, you know, for the sufficiency of Adam's, you know, continuity, you know, in Edwards talked about the presence of the Holy Spirit being necessary, the withdrawal of the presence, et cetera, then the presence of sinful self-love and so forth. And those things figure into it. At the end of the day, I have to say, it seems to me that Edwards' treatise on original sin, and y'all may disagree with me on that, is probably not his finest moment.
Yeah, it's got some good parts, but yeah, it's with regard, ultimately, this is the way I think I summed it up at my defense. In order to avoid attributing sin to God, in other words, making God the author of sin, he ends up basically making man a defective creature.
Right, God created the imperfect.
Right, and that's a problem. Now, here's
a similar problem to Roman Catholic doctrine. Traditionally,
it's that's one of the issues I deal with. I argue that Edwards did not hold to a donum super additum view, which Gerstner says he did, and I deal with that at some length. It looks like it, but here's the thing: this is a problem primarily for the Reform, because other traditions do not believe that Adam and Eve were created righteous, holy, and with true knowledge. They would argue that Adam and Eve were created neutral. In other words, they would have to choose to be obedient or choose to be disobedient. Therefore, they couldn't be created. They couldn't come from the hand of God as righteous already.
They're not in a positive or negative state. They're just correct. They just are.
And you can see how this would relate to Edwards' discussion of freedom of the will as well. But in the, what happens is it again, the question is raised, how can a creature who is created righteous and holy with true knowledge, again, drawing from Colossians and Ephesians, remember John Calvin's hermeneutical move, what is regained in redemption is what was lost in the fall. That's how Calvin was thought about the passages in Ephesians 4 and Colossians 3.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get back to the question, okay, what happened that led Adam to rebel against God? And Edwards wrestles with this question throughout his ministry, because he's got several miscellanies apart from the treatise on original sin and sermons. It clearly he wasn't comfortable with all of the formulations that he worked on in his miscellanies. I think it's miscellany 290 or 209, I forget now, where he recognizes early on that this is a conundrum.
290.
Is it 290? Okay.
The one where he talks about, seeing he had no sinful inclinations in him, except God took away his grace from him. Right. Is that the one where he's taking away sufficient grace or efficacious grace?
Yeah, there's this whole discussion, of course, about his use of language. And what Dr. Gerstner says is that, well, what Edwards does is label the elements that are involved in the fall, but he doesn't provide an explanation. And that gets to that efficacious, sufficient grace distinction. Mm-hmm. Peter Beck, in a 2007 Evangelical Quarterly article that goes by the title "The Fall of Man" or "The Fall of Adam and the Failure of Jonathan Edwards," points out this problem in Edwards' treatment of the fall, saying that it's a problem. And how can a righteous creature have a sinful inclination? And Peter thinks he has an answer that actually comes from within the theology of Edwards himself, and that's the notion of self-love. Self-love is a capacity that God has created in man, so it is neither righteous nor wicked considered in itself.
Mm-hmm.
God intended for the love of God to rule over love of self. And at the fall, love of God was removed, and so Adam resorted to self-love. And when he looked at the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and was invited to partake what Eve had taken from the tree, that appeared to be the greatest good at that particular moment. And so he partook. That is, I think, a useful discussion. I think Peter has hit on something. However, I don't think it's ultimately that it's the answer at the end of the day.
So it seems under that scheme that in the moment of partaking of the tree, Adam thought he was doing what was right.
Right. Edwards elsewhere will talk about Adam being distracted.
Huh. Yeah, that seems to discount the disobedience.
Well, that's certainly not Edwards' intent.
Well, sure, but I'm just speaking as a person who's hearing this for the first time.
what Edwards is, and David, maybe you can, add something here. But what Edwards is trying to avoid, remember what Edwards says in the treatise on original sin. He says, "How do we account for the universality and the prevalency of sin?" As sinful acts. Everywhere we look and in all ages, man commits sin. Well, he says there has to be a uniform cause, and he'll argue that a sinful disposition must precede a sinful act, just like a holy disposition must precede a holy act. Now, the problem with that, and he'll even talk that way about Adam, but you can see the problem there, can't you? Where does the sinful disposition come from?
Mm-hmm.
And so many scholars have pointed out, well, Edwards' discussion is great when you're thinking about us who are already inherited a sinful nature. His discussion is perfectly fine, but it still doesn't tell us how did a creature created in righteousness, holiness, and true knowledge have a sinful inclination. And Edwards, as I said, Edwards' one answer, one possibility, he said, is the being distracted. And I should tell you, the professors weren't impressed with that one yesterday.
I could see it as an explanation, although I don't find it sufficient myself either. But
it's not.
Yeah.
You know, another way he goes at that, Jeff, is with regard to that grace being taken away from him. Back to Miscellany 290, Edward says, if it be inquired how man came to sin, seeing he had no sinful inclinations in him, except God took away his grace from him that he had been wont to give him and so let him fall, I answer, there was no need of that. There was no need of taking away any that had been given him, but he sinned under that temptation because God did not give him more.
Right.
Did not take away that grace from him while he was perfectly innocent, which grace was his original righteousness, but he only withheld his confirming grace, that grace which is now, which is given now in heaven, such grace as shall fit the soul to surmount every temptation. This was the grace Adam was to have had if he had stood when he came to receive his reward. This grace was not obliged. This grace God was not obliged to grant him. Then he says, "See, Master, duvelitione frideris naturi," the violation of the covenant of nature. And so the sin certainly followed the temptation of the devil. So that as the sin of mankind, it came from the devil. So it's sort of a devil made me do it kind of thing. But then in the very next statement, Edwards says, because he sees the logical conundrum he's in, okay, if it came from the devil, well then, you know, whence cometh the devil's, you know, right, temptation to begin with? And so he says, then the question is, how came the devil by it, seeing he had no tempter? I answer, 'tis probably some extraordinary manifestation of God's sovereignty was his temptation of his sin and rebellion. And so in some ways that's, right, less than satisfactory answer. He realizes the logical problem, but he doesn't really give an answer then other than just to say some extraordinary manifestation of God's sovereignty.
Right. Two things I would want to note. I'll note them, and then I'll, if I can, I'll make some comment on both. One is that notice, while we don't think the answer is satisfactory, he's drawing upon the resources of covenant theology and the affirmation of the blessing of confirmed righteousness had Adam been obedient. What he's
certainly,
okay, that's the first point. The second point is he wrestles with the question of, okay, well, if Satan is the ultimate source of evil and sin, how did he become evil? Now, let me answer that one first, then I'll go back to the covenant theology issue. Edwards offers, and I forget where he talks about this, maybe David can help us with that. He basically suggests somewhere in his corpus that Satan rebelled when God revealed that the Son of God would take to himself a true body and a reasonable soul. The angels were the servants of the Son of God, among others, and therefore Satan, Lucifer, the archangel, rebels against God because Satan doesn't want to serve a human being who is, according to Lucifer, created lower than the angels. Of course, that making reference to the book of Hebrews and the book of Psalms. So that's one suggestion that Edwards makes with regard to how did Satan end up being evil. That's, you can take that and however you want. Then the first issue of the covenant. It's interesting what he's saying. You know, remember how Voss has said that eschatology precedes soteriology. Mm-hmm. That's the principle at work behind what Edwards says here. He basically says that God withheld the grace he would have given had Adam been obedient, the confirming grace, right? Mm-hmm. He withholds that, so Adam falls. Okay, that led me to say in my dissertation that basically what he's saying is only the Son of God could have withstood the probation.
Hmm.
And in fact goes on and did keep the covenant of works perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
That is, while interesting and ingenious, just still doesn't answer the question how a righteous creature could have a sinful inclination.
Yeah.
You end up either blaming God because God didn't have to give confirming righteousness or confirming grace, and didn't, so God's at fault, or the creature is imperfect. Frankly, both sides of the coin are not that great.
No. Any thoughts on that, David?
Yeah, I'm with Jeff. I think it's not satisfactory, but man, it's fascinating, and it is ingenious. Especially the way he eventually comes out with Christ being the only one who could have withstood. But I wonder if, Jeff, and I don't know if you've dealt with this in the dissertation, I can't wait to read it, but with regard to God's involvement in that, withholding that confirming grace, et cetera, what do you think of, Edwards' differentiation between the causa efficiens and the causa deficiens, the issue of causality?
Right, right. And,
how do we account for God's, dare I say it, causality in this? How do we nuance his causality so that we're still confessional, right? He is not he's not the cause of sin, but Edwards deals with that. Did you write?
Yeah, Edwards will I don't go into a lot of I do some detail, but not a lot. Edwards will deal with the question, is God the author of sin? And he'll say, not in the popular sense, but if we mean in the sense that in his decrees, he allows for sin to arise, because Edwards subscribes to the Felix Culpa understanding of the fall, right? Mm-hmm. The oh happy fall or oh happy sin.
Right.
In other words, we experience more of God's love because of the fall and subsequent redemption than we would have experienced without it. Okay, that's the Felix Culpa notion that we find in Edwards. With regard to the efficient and deficient cause, it might be helpful to explain what that means for our listeners. An efficient cause, God does something, that's an efficient cause. A deficient cause is God by not doing something, something else follows. I'll give you an example. In I think the Gerstner uses this one. The sun sets, it grows dark, and the temperature drops. Okay, is the sun the cause of the forming of ice? No, it's the absence of the sun that's the deficient cause of the cold temperatures and the forming of ice. I don't know if that's helpful, but that's the illustration that I've often used. And with regard to
he does
fall,
that in the Freedom of the Will, actually, interestingly enough.
He does. That's right.
Does that distinction in the Freedom of the Will so that our listeners might think of it as positive agency or positive causality, and for lack of a better word, versus passive causality or passive agency.
I think that's a fair, and the problem, of course, is you at the end of the day, you end up in the same place, don't you? I mean, you end up saying, okay, God withheld, by God's not doing something, he guaranteed that Adam would fall.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at one of the other things that Edwards will say that also Augustine says, is that we're dealing simply with the creator-creature distinction. Only God is holy by necessity. Creatures are not.
So that at the end of the day, what you're dealing with, it seems to me, with Edwards and all of this, is God withdraws, and we're left with the creaturely, being. By virtue of being creaturely, there is, dare I say it, the propensity, the ability for the creaturely to be less than creator.
Right.
Less than
perfect. And we would grant that, wouldn't we?
Yes.
We would say that there's no sense in which the creature is the creator.
Of course, right.
And that's kind of what Edwards and others like Augustine are getting at. There is no There is no identity between God and his creatures. However, we grant that point because it's biblical. There something doesn't seem quite right. What it's suggesting is that, again, it's suggesting a defective creation rather than a limited creation. In other words, one of the struggles in Western philosophy and Western history, very often the human predicament is ascribed to finitude, not sin. Mm-hmm. And what you see here is Edwards actually wrestling with that temptation, I think. The temptation to attribute to the creatureliness of the creature, mm-hmm. the fall. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Again, I don't know that they're, you know, I tend to be in agreement with Gerster and say, okay, we affirm what the Bible teaches at this point, but it may be that we are running up against the limits of our ability to understand. I'm sympathetic to that assessment.
Of course.
Yeah.
There's a large element of mystery here. And scripture does not exhaust the topic for us. That's not its purpose, but it's difficult because we're running up against the limits of human knowledge and ability to know, as well as what God has chosen to reveal and what he's chosen not to reveal.
The struggle here is the implication that God was nasty and mean by withholding something that he really should have given.
Right. Well, here's a question for me, because at least formally speaking, there seem to be similarities with the Roman Catholic classical doctrine of the Donum Super Additum. Can you speak about that doctrine and then distinguish it from what Edwards is proposing?
The classical doctrine of the Donum Super Additum, or the super added gift, is that the reason why God creates man is so that man can have the beatific vision, the visio dei. Man cannot have the visio dei without gracious assistance by God. That's as he's created. On the other hand, man as mere creature lives and thinks and is in a perfectly adequate way. So there's dialectic going on there. What I think Van Til referred to as the rational-irrational dialectic at work right there in the Donum Super Additum. And this was an issue raised by Dr. Tipton yesterday. There are differences between the Roman Catholic doctrine and the idea of concupiscence, right, which is what we're talking about here, the finitude of the creature. We would look at that and say, that's not finitude, that's sinfulness. Mm-hmm. Concupiscence, right? We would say, okay. Right. Where in Roman Catholic doctrine, concupiscence, the weakness of the flesh, is built into human creation.
Right, and they would see that it is not sin. They're very keen on affirming that, but that it leads to or can lead to sin.
One difference between Edwards and the Donum, and I spend a fair bit of time on this, is that in the Roman Catholic doctrine, at least as Thomas Aquinas taught it, and as Robert Cardinal Bellarmine taught it, and as Turretin understood Roman Catholicism, there was a slogan, only the supernaturals were lost and the naturals remain. What that's getting at is what we often in Reform circles refer to as the distinction between the broader and narrower image of God. The broader image would be things like rationality, relationality, those kinds of things, the ability to have fellowship with God and with other human beings. And for the Roman Catholic doctrine, when you lose the Donum Super Additum, the superadded gift, you lose the icing on the cake, but the cake is perfectly fine, though limited. If I can use that illustration. For Edwards and for the Reformed Scholastics, for instance, they would have nothing to do with that notion. When the narrow image, which would be the righteousness, holiness, and true knowledge, when that is lost, the natural image becomes twisted and distorted. So that is a difference between Edwards and the Roman Catholic understanding of the superadded gift.
Yeah, definitely.
But it is right. There are formal similarities, and you have to read very closely. And one could argue, okay, well, maybe there's issues there that Edwards could have extracted or could have saved himself a lot of heartache had he been more thoughtful. However, having said that, he is a child of his times, although that's never an excuse, especially in the face of the scriptures.
Yeah, that's true. What are your thoughts on this, David? You familiar much with the Catholic doctrine on this issue, or what do you see as being an advantage to what Edwards is doing, and what might be some disadvantages?
Well, I think, you know, the disadvantage is that it does play into the hands of those who want to critique Edwards for being overly speculative. I think there's a difference, for instance, between Edwards and, say, Calvin, who was willing, perhaps more readily, to live with mystery, in a sense. And Edwards wanted to trace things down as far as he could. And that could be, as Jeff was saying a second ago here, a matter of him being a child of his day and of his age. I do agree with what Jeff said, though. I think the way Jeff nuanced that is really good. There is a difference between Edwards and the Roman Catholic doctrine there. At the end of the day, though, I think what we're left with Edwards on this is some inherent propensity, if I can say it that way, for deficiency within the creature.
Yeah, that seems to be the case.
That would probably be, that's the element that looks like the donum. Yeah. It's the inherent deficiency in the creature.
Right.
That's what looks like the donum, and it is a problem. And I say so. In that chapter, I'm really not Edward's friend in chapter two when we're dealing with the account of the fall.
What implications does this have on apologetics? Even though, again, we're speaking a little bit anachronistically, right, here, but what implications does this have for Edwards in the way he develops other parts of his theology, but also what implications might this have for the present day?
Right. Well, clearly, from my perspective, at least, Edwards' notion, or if you affirm the donum superadditum doctrine, you're going to have a notion of the intellect, which is not, we would say, is not fallen. Or the noetic effects of sin are minimal.
Right.
So, and that's going to impinge upon your apologetic practice. It will probably tend toward an intellectualistic approach. Now, understand me, when I use that expression, intellectualistic, I'm not disparaging the life of the mind. I just completed a doctoral program. That would be a pretty bad misuse of my years and money and the time of the professors and so forth to pursue that, thinking that there wasn't any importance to the mind. However, but there is a tendency to think that maybe arguments by themselves will win people. Edwards would never have countenanced that notion. He understood that the Holy Spirit was the one who brought a person to faith in Christ. And that's, I think, rather obvious in the overall thrust of his theology and preaching. In terms of, Edwards does use some of the classical arguments in apologetics. However, they're never argued in a neutral sense. You don't get in Edwards an argument for the existence of God that is completely shorn of a biblical or scriptural foundation. For instance, the one place where he rolls out all of the major classical arguments, the ontological, the teleological, the cosmological, is in a sermon on Romans 1:20, where Paul talks about ever since the creation, God has been made known. And Edwards believes he's actually expositing that passage in Romans chapter 1 when he gives those arguments. Now, in my dissertation, I didn't really get into, are these arguments sound or valid? Because that wasn't my point. Now, maybe now I can say, the one thing I did say was, if they have soundness, and our listeners may be familiar with the difference between soundness, validity, and soundness. A validity is the formal structure of an argument. Soundness is validity plus truth. Are his arguments sound? Mm-hmm. Only on the presupposition of the biblical God, I would argue.
Mm-hmm.
And remember when I quoted Ava Chamberlain earlier, whenever Edwards argues in favor of God or for a particular Christian doctrine, he always presupposes its truth. That, to me, is a major difference from the classical model as we typically know it.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's a foundational difference, and one that's very important. We don't find very often in people like Edwards, especially that time period.
Now, he's a revelational theologian. He argues for the necessity of
absolutely
revelation all over the place. I mean, you know, one of the sermons the listeners may be more aware of is his sermon on the necessity of acquiring Christian knowledge, where he makes it plain that the heathens, apart from necessary revelation, that there is not that possibility of knowing God. He's revelational throughout his corpus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I suppose if we were to put on our critical, you know, garb, we would say Edwards is probably not wholly consistent.
Mm-hmm.
As Vantillians, and we're all Vantillians here, we would say, okay, you've got some great elements here. You've got some elements that are less than stellar. Let's sit down and talk about these things. Edwards did not seek to introduce a new apologetic method. One of the things I said in the dissertation was probably the best thing we can say about Edwards with regard to the classical method is that if he was a classical apologist, he just happened to be one.
Or he was a bad one.
Right. Or by accident of his historical location.
Yeah.
Right. By that I mean the basic point, he came before Van Til.
right. Or the Dutch. Probably wasn't highly influenced by Dutch theologians. But
Maastricht, though. I mean, Maastricht was heavily influential for him, though.
But you look at even a guy like Bavinck, and he's got streaks in him that are, right, you know, not entirely in line with the type of apologetic and approach that Van Til presents. So,
right. I think there is an inconsistency. If he was a classical apologist, there's certainly an inconsistency there. Dr. Oliphant did an article several years ago for WTJ on Edwards as a Reformed apologist. But I think this whole discussion points up, you know, my opinion on, so, you know, you mentioned Gerstner there and having great affection for Gerstner, as I'm sure we all do. But the first volume of the Rational Biblical Theology of Edwards, I mean, it seems pretty obvious. Like he's going to great lengths to cast Edwards as a card-carrying classical apologist. And of that whole three volumes set, I think that is probably my least favorite part of his treatment of Edwards.
Right. I mean, one of the most obvious differences between, say, Dr. Gerstner and Jonathan Edwards is Edwards doesn't have the anti-presuppositional bias,
right,
that flavors Dr. Gerstner's discussion of these issues. That's part of what I mean when I say Edwards does not exhibit a self-awareness of his apologetic method. He just does it.
He just does what he does, right.
Right, exactly. Avery Dulles, the Roman Catholic cardinal, wrote a book on the history of apologetics, and he basically argues that self-awareness or self-conscious awareness of epistemology is not something that Christian apologists practice until after Immanuel Kant.
Right.
Which is interesting, but and of course Edwards predates Immanuel Kant and is actually their contemporaries for a while, but in terms of the influence of Kant and subsequent philosophy and theology, it wasn't there for Edwards.
In some ways, maybe necessity is the mother of invention, and so post Enlightenment, there is more of a necessity to be more aware of one's epistemology.
Right.
Yeah, precisely. So, Jeff, where are you going from here? Having finished the dissertation, I'm sure there are a number of different questions and topics that interest you. Do you seek to carry on this research in Edwards' anthropology? Are you going to be shifting gears, pivoting? What's going to be going?
Yeah, Edwards will always be a conversation partner for me, but by no means is he the only interest that I have. And even look at Dr. Gerstner. He was a well-known Edwards scholar, but he didn't limit his writing or his teaching to Edwards. Mm-hmm. Right? There were lots of things that he wrote on. And as I told the gentleman yesterday, in my defense, I don't consider myself an Edwardsian in the sense that that term is usually used, because there are areas of disagreement that I have with Edwards, and I am more comfortable with being, you know, a Westminsterian. And by that, I mean confession, not just the seminary, although I am happy to be identified with the Westminster Seminary as well. But for instance, Ken Minkema, who's the executive editor of the Edwards, the Yale edition of the Edwards works, and also the director of the center, has written an article called Dortian Philosophy, Jonathan Edwards, John Calvin, and Reformed Scholasticism or Reformed Tradition. And he highlights three areas where Edwards is different from or departs from the consensus of the Reformed tradition. One is his idealism. Two is his historicism. And three is his progressive millennialism. Wow. And I would agree with that assessment of Dr. Minkema. And I would be standing on the other side of the divide in all three instances. So I'm not an idealist. I'm not a historicist. And by historicist, we mean someone who ties every element of the Book of Revelation to some particular historical event in post New Testament church history. And I'm certainly not a post-millennialist or a progressive millennialist. I'm an amillennialist. What I was saying to the professors was I see myself more in the line of old Princeton. In other words, we appreciate Edwards, and I'm probably closer to Samuel Miller and Archibald Alexander in their appreciation for Edwards than, say, Charles Hodge. In other words, I'm the scale is tipped in favor of Edwards, whereas with Hodge it tended to be maybe equilibrium. With Warfield, a little more positive, but that's how I see myself, as more like I look at Edwards as the way old Princeton did.
Yeah, A. Hodge spoke of Edwards as being full of ideas, some of which needed regulating, very diplomatically.
Yes.
Yeah, that's helpful. That's interesting. Well, Jeff, we want to thank you for taking the time to join us and for sharing with us a bit about this chapter. We're delighted that you were able to defend your dissertation, and we look forward to people being able to pick this up and read it somehow. If people have questions, how would you like them to contact you? Through the comments on the website, email?
They can email me at jwaddington. Well, you can put the email address out there.
We can send them along. You can email mail at reformedforum.org.
Right, exactly. Send those along, and I'll get them. I'm
the you try every combination of Jay Waddington something and see where it goes.
Yeah, exactly. The dissertation will be available through ProQuest, I think, 4 to 6 months from now.
Yeah, and that'll be for a nominal fee of
somewhere
$50.
Between, around 50, depending on whether you want hardbound, paperback, or they also sell it as loosely, as unbound.
Right.
Now you can also wait until, should I choose to pursue regular publication?
Mm-hmm.
You can wait till then. But anyways, you know, feel free to write me if you have any questions, or write to the Reform Forum and they'll pass it along.
Great. Well, thanks, Jeff. We appreciate it. And you can find Jeff online here and there. You can find him at alliancenet.org, the fruits of his labors there, as well as feedingonchrist.com. And David is at teachinglikerain.wordpress.com. And what's the church website, David?
It's christpres.org.
Christpres.org. You can find me online at hopeopc.com. And you can find all of us at reformedforum.org. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.